Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 93.
We're kicking things off today with a really quite profound verse. These words right at the start here, Chapter 93, they feel like they set a serious tone. What do they, you know, immediately signal about the inner journey?
It's a very powerful way to start, isn't it? These lines, they really hammer home those key themes of detachment, of purification, which are just so central to the whole pilgrimage. When it says, harboring thoughts certainly brings love, lingering emotions inevitably invite disaster, that speaks directly to, well, needing to let go, to release those worldly ties.
Right, the attachment.
Exactly. And the part about whether becoming immortal or becoming Buddha, it must be arranged from within. That points straight to the internal work. It's about self-cultivation, not just, you know, external goals. It really foreshadows the depth of their quest.
That sets the stage perfectly. With that profound verse still hanging in the air, the story pivots pretty quickly back to the practical side. We hear that after they left their last stop, the monks there woke up and found them gone. They were quite upset, weren't they?
Yeah, they were lamenting, saying things like, we didn't keep them, didn't say goodbye. So cleanly, the living bodhisattvas were let go. They actually believed the pilgrims had, well, literally driven clouds away.
Driven clouds away. That's quite an image.
It is. And this idea, this perception of them as living bodhisattvas who left so mysteriously, it spread like wildfire through the city. Officials, common folk, everyone heard about it.
And what was the reaction?
Spontaneous offerings appeared at shrines, things like 5 sacrificial animals and fruit. It just shows the huge impact they had, the sort of reverence and almost worship they inspired in people.
So the journey rolls on. About half a month passes. They've been, as the text says, eating wind and lodging in water, just constantly exposed to the elements, always moving.
Goofing it, basically.
Definitely. And the path's been peaceful, surprisingly. But then, naturally, a high mountain appears on the horizon. And Tripitaka, well, he starts to get that familiar feeling of apprehension.
Classic Tripitaka. But Sun Wukong steps in with this real confidence. He laughs it off, saying, here, near Buddha Land, there won't be any evil demons. Master, relax, don't worry.
What does that tell us? Is Wukong just being optimistic, or is there more to it?
Well, it signals a potential shift, I think. Wukong seems to believe they're entering a more sacred zone, closer to their goal. Maybe the challenge has changed now, less about fighting demons, perhaps more about internal struggles. It feels like a marker of their progress.
Still, Tripitaka isn't easily reassured. He's focused on the distance that 2,000 line to the capital of Tensuku, the monks mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Always counting the miles.
He needs his itinerary.
He does. And this is where Wukong poses that really sharp question. He asks, Master, have you forgotten the Heart Sutra from Zen Master Wu Chao?
Ah, yes. And that question just ignites this fascinating debate about what understanding even means. Tripitaka's reaction is so human, so defensive.
Totally. He says, the Prajna Heart Sutra is my constant companion. How could I forget it? He even brags he can recite it backwards.
But Wukong doesn't let it go. He cuts right through that, saying, Master merely recites it, but never asks that master to interpret it.
Grasping the meaning.
Boom. That's the core issue right there.
It really is. Knowing the words versus grasping the meaning.
Exactly. Is recitation enough? Wukong implies it isn't.
And Tripitaka, feeling challenged, basically says, oh yeah, monkey, how dare you say I don't get it? Do you understand it?
You can just picture Wukong's grin when he says, bold as ever, I understand, I understand.
Oh, definitely. And the reactions are great. Pigsy apparently fell over laughing. Sandy was just delighted.
They find it hilarious. Pigsy and Sandy jump right in, mocking Wukong. You know, since when does a monster like you preach? They think he's just making excuses, that he only knows how to swing his staff, not interpret scripture.
They're so skeptical. Classic group dynamic.
It highlights their own biases about Wukong, for sure.
So amidst all this laughter and skepticism, how does Tripitaka, the master, settle this? It's quite a moment.
It really is. He defends Wukong, and his defense is profound, he says. Wukong's understanding is without words or text. That is true understanding.
Wow. Without words or text.
Yeah. And that just throws open this huge question, doesn't it? For them and for us listening. What is this true understanding that goes beyond language, beyond the scripture itself?
It suggests something experiential, intuitive.
Perhaps. Maybe it implies that deep spiritual insight isn't always found in books or lectures, but through, well, direct knowing. A kind of wisdom that words can't fully capture.
It really makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah.
About how we learn. Are we sometimes just reciting, or are we truly, you know, understanding?
A very relevant question.
So while they're having this deep discussion, they're still walking, covering quite a bit of ground, passing several mountain peaks. And then up ahead, they spot a large monastery.
And the description paints a picture, doesn't it? Not too big, not too small. Glazed green tiles, half new, half old. An 8-character red wall. It sounds like a place with history.
Mm-hmm. Ancient pines, murmuring water. You get a real sense of age and peace.
Yeah.
And there are signs. The main gate says, Dujin Shanxi.
Which means Monastery of Spreading Gold.
Exactly. And another plaque reads, Ancient Relic. And that name, Bujin, Spreading Gold, it immediately clicks something for Tripitaka.
Yes, the scholar in him awakens. He starts thinking aloud, Bujin, Bujin. Could this be related to the Jetavana kingdom?
And he recalls this specific story from the scriptures, right? Mm. About the Jeta Grove Anathapindika Park.
He does. It's a fantastic connection. He remembers the story of the elder Anathapindika wanting to buy Prince Jeta's garden so the Buddha could teach there.
And the prince sets this seemingly impossible price.
Right. He says, basically, only if you cover the entire garden floor with gold. A task meant to be prohibitive.
But Anathapindika's devotion was just immense.
Absolutely incredible. The story goes that he immediately used gold as bricks, spreading them to fill the entire garden just to secure the land for the Buddha's teachings.
Just wow. Paving a park with gold out of sheer devotion.
It's an extraordinary image of faith and commitment.
And that's the connection. Bijin, spreading gold. The monastery's name directly references this ancient act of profound generosity.
Oh.
It makes you stop and think, how does a place get a name like that? What power lies in these founding stories?
It speaks volumes about the legacy of faith and how these acts resonate through centuries.
Of course, Pigsy brings it back down to earth with a joke.
Always reliable for that. He says something like, great, if this is the place, let's grab a gold brick or two as souvenirs.
Gotta love Pigsy. So they head towards the monastery gate. And it's quite a busy scene. People everywhere carrying poles, carrying bags, pushing carts, some resting, some talking. A real mix.
A slice of everyday life right at the monastery entrance.
And when the four pilgrims arrive, the text calls them handsome and ugly, which is a blunt way of putting it. There's a moment of fear in the crowd.
Yeah.
But people move aside.
And Tripitaka's immediate instinct is to restore calm. He keeps saying, which means be civilized, be civilized.
Trying to keep things orderly.
Exactly. And it works. The crowd quiets down. It shows his approach relying on his presence and a call for decorum rather than any kind of force.
As they walk further in, past the Vajra Hall, they're met by one of the monks. And the description is lovely. Face like a full moon, body like a Bodhi tree, staff in hand, sleeves fluttering. Straw sandals.
A very serene and dignified image. He looks the part of a wise monk.
And the exchange is very formal, very respectful. Tripitaka introduces himself properly. Jinjuan Zhang states his mission from the east.
And the monk immediately recognizes the significance. He welcomes him as a divine monk from the east, offering lodging right away. There's this instant respect for the quest itself.
It really highlights how renowned their mission has become.
Absolutely. The sacred nature of their journey is understood and honored, and they're formally invited into the abbot's quarters, sitting properly as host and guest, with Wukong, Baji, and Sandy respectfully waiting. It sets a tone of solemnity and respect for the place they've arrived at. Monks of all levels are there, gathering to greet the famous monk from the east, from Tang, China.
A big deal.
Oh, yeah. And after all the respectful greetings and formalities, they serve a vegetarian meal.
And this is where we get a classic character moment, isn't it? While the head abbot is still, you know, reciting verses.
Mm-hmm.
Our friend Zubaji is already diving in. The text paints this great picture, doesn't it? Steamed buns, vegetarian food, soup stirred down.
Yeah.
He just goes for it.
He really does. It's such a fantastic bit of realism, almost comedic.
What do you think the author is doing there? Putting that raw hunger right next to the spiritual setting?
Well, I think it's brilliant. You've got some monks praising Tripitaka, you know, his dignity, and then others are just watching Baji absolutely inhale his food.
Right.
It's a reminder, isn't it? Even in these sacred places, basic human needs like hunger, they're right there. They often kind of push past the decorum.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It suggests that maybe enlightenment isn't about, you know, totally denying that stuff, but finding a way to live with it, integrating it somehow.
That's a really interesting take. And then you have Xiao Wujing, who's always sort of the observant one.
The long-suffering one, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. He tries to subtly nudge Baji, like under the table, trying to get him to show some refinement.
But Baji's having none of it. His reaction is just priceless. He yells out, refinement, refinement, my stomach is empty.
Classic Baji.
Absolutely. And Wujing's response is actually quite profound in its own way.
What does he say again?
He says something like, how many refined people are there in the world? If you really think about their stomachs, they're just like you and me.
Hmm. That really cuts through everything, doesn't it?
It does. It's funny, but it also grounds this whole spiritual journey in a very, very basic, earthy reality. Mm. Needs versus how society expects us to act.
Yeah, you feel that grounding. And speaking of grounding, this Jigu temple itself, it's not just any old temple. It has quite a history.
Oh, definitely. Its original name was much longer, the Srivasti Jetavana Anathapindika Park Monastery, also just known as Jetavana.
Okay.
But its current name, Bhujan Temple, that means gold paving temple. And there's an amazing story behind that.
Right. Tell us about that.
It comes from this figure, Anathapindika. He was this incredibly wealthy elder known for his generosity. His name even means something like giver of alms to the destitute.
Wow.
And the story is, to convince the Buddha to come and teach there, he literally paved the ground of the park with gold bricks.
Paved it? With actual gold?
That's the legend. An immense display of devotion showing the kind of wealth and sacrifice involved in, you know, spreading Buddhism early on.
That's incredible. And there's another detail in the text, isn't there? Something about the original site.
Yes. It mentions that the original Jetavana site, you know, the place Anathapindika bought, is supposedly still behind the current temple. You can see old stone wall bits.
Oh.
And supposedly, after heavy rain, people with good fortune sometimes find gold there.
No way. That adds such a layer of, well, mystical realism, I guess.
Exactly. It perfectly blends the historical location with the sort of mythical aura of the story. It feels like the generosity of the past is still kind of present in the land.
That fits the whole feel of Journey to the West so well.
It really does. But beyond the temple's history and richness, there's also a very practical reason they have to stop here. It's not just a pleasant visit.
Ah, right, the danger.
Yeah, the area around there is called Hundred Legged Mountain.
Hundred Legged Mountain. Okay, oh, that sounds ominous.
It is. Recently, it's been plagued by, get this, centipede spirits.
Centipede spirits, seriously.
Yep, they injure travelers. The text says not fatally, thankfully, but they make it incredibly hard to pass through.
So, another obstacle. Not always monsters trying to eat the monk. Sometimes it's giant spirit centipedes making the road impassable.
Precisely. It shows the variety of challenges. Not all are epic battles. Some just stop you in your tracks.
And this leads to a local custom.
Right. Because of these centipedes, there's a place nearby called Rooster Crow Gate, and the local custom is nobody dares to try and pass through until the rooster crows in the morning.
Ah, so safety in the daylight, or maybe the crowing itself is significant?
The text implies it's about waiting for morning, for safety. So all the traveling merchants, and Tangbunk's group too, they have no choice. They have to stay at the temple overnight.
Waiting for the all clear from the rooster.
Exactly. It just highlights again how much they depend on local knowledge, local conditions. Even with Sun Wukong's powers, sometimes you just have to wait.
So the day winds down. They've had their meal. They know they're stuck till morning. What happens next?
Well, things get a bit quieter, more reflective. Tripitaka and Sun Wukong go for a walk. It's evening. The moon's out, an upper crescent moon, the text says.
A nice image. A moment of peace.
Seems like it. And during their walk, they meet an elder monk from the temple.
Okay.
This monk seems quite keen to talk to them. He expresses the strong desire to meet Chinese figures, recognizing Tripitaka's important journey. It shows the respect people had for these pilgrims from the East.
Yeah, and then he gets into this interesting bit about age, but it's kind of humorous. Sanzang politely says he's 45 years old.
And then the elder monk says he's one jiazi older. A jiazi is a 60-year cycle in the traditional calendar.
So add 60 years, he's 105.
Exactly. A remarkable age.
Wow.
And then Wukong, you know, being Wukong, sort of playfully challenges the old guy. Asks him, okay, wise guy, how old do you think I am? You can almost see him grinning. But the old monk is sharp. He gives this really clever dodge.
Right, he doesn't guess. He says he can't tell because of Wukong's high skill and also the moonmit vision.
Yeah.
Basically saying Wukong's not just anyone. It's a fun little moment, shows character, sets up Wukong's special abilities quite nicely, I think.
Definitely. So after that interesting exchange, Sanzang's mind goes somewhere else. He asks about a historical spot nearby, the base of the Jetavana or Jigu Garden.
And the old monk tells him, well, it's not much now, just an empty piece of land, really. Uh-huh. Maybe some scattered stone wall remnants.
Yeah.
Kind of poignant, you know.
Yeah.
This hugely important place, historically and spiritually, is just fading away physically. Mm-hmm. But the memory, the legacy, that's still strong.
Yeah, and that legacy hits Sun Zong hard. When he sees the spot, he's really moved. He even recites this poem. It's about Su Da, this famous benefactor who helped the poor, and acknowledges Jetavana's fame. But then he wonders, like, where are these great people now? It's all about legacy, compassion, themes running through the whole book, really.
Exactly.
Deep thoughts.
And right then, just as he's in that reflective mood, they hear something unsettling, a sound of crying. He describes it strangely as words of parents unaware of suffering, which is odd.
And that sound, whatever it is, it hits Sun Zong instantly. It says he was touched to the heart and unconsciously shed tears. His empathy is
Yeah.
just immense. It really makes you stop and think, doesn't it? What kind of pain, what kind of suffering could possibly make this revered monk cry just from hearing it?
Totally shifts the mood. And the old monk sees Sun Zhang's reaction, right? So he does something, well, pretty unusual. He sends the other monks away. And then when they're alone, he bows, like a deep bow, to both Sun Zhang and Wukong. Yeah, which is significant. And he explains why. He says, you know, being over 100, he understands human affairs and karma differently. He even claims he's seen a few times sights unseen by ordinary people during meditation. So he's setting himself up as someone with, let's say, special insight. And here's the key part, I think. He tells them, Sun Zhang and Wukong, they're different from others. And critically, he says only Wukong, because of his high skill, can actually figure out what's causing this crying.
Right, so the pressure's on Wukong now.
It really raises the stakes. Wukong's the one who can solve this.
So, okay, the old monk finally starts explaining the crying. Says it started exactly a year ago today. He heard this gust of wind and then these sounds of lament and
And
grievance.
when he went to check it out on the Jetavana base, he found this girl, described as beautiful and upright. She told him she was a princess in the Tunsu kingdom. Her story was, well, pretty wild. She claimed she was just gazing at the moon and got blown by the wind all the way there.
Blown by the wind. Okay. And the monk's reaction to finding a princess who claims she was blown there by wind is to lock her up. He puts her in a dilapidated, empty room, basically a prison cell, just a little hole for passing a bowl through. Seems harsh.
It does, on the surface. But his explanation is complex. He tells Sun Zhang and Wukong that publicly, to the other monks, he said she was a demon. But privately, he says he did it out of compassion. Didn't want to harm her, so he kept her hidden, giving her just basic coarse tea and coarse food to keep her alive. His form of mercy, I suppose, protecting her from, well, maybe from the other monks.
Ah, okay. And the princess, she figures this out.
Seems like it. The text says she understood his real reason to protect her from potential defilement by the others. So she played along in a way. She
Oh.
feigned madness and strangeness, started acting radically, wetting the bed, talking nonsense during the day.
But that was all an act.
Apparently. Because at night, when she thought she was alone, she'd stop the act and just cry for her parents.
Wow. That's actually really smart of her, a survival tactic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the old monk, he wasn't just taking her word for it or acting purely on impulse. He says he checked in the city nearby, confirmed that, as far as anyone knew, no harm had actually come to the real princess back home. Which makes her story even stranger, right?
Yeah, wait. So the princess in the city is fine?
That's what he found out. But he still kept this girl firmly locked up. He didn't let her go. Perhaps Wukong, given what he said earlier.
Right. Wukong's discernment. So the monk wraps it up with a plea. He asks Wukong to use his divine powers and dharma power when they get to the Shravasti country to basically discern the truth, find out what's really going on with this girl.
And he frames it with his dual purpose. It's not just about solving the mystery. It's first to save the good and virtuous, meaning the girl, presumably if she's innocent, and second to manifest the divine powers of Buddhist Dharma. So it's about justice, compassion, and demonstrating the power of their faith and wisdom. It connects the personal story to their larger spiritual quest.
And Sun Zhang and Wukong, they hear all this and they're deeply moved. You can imagine, it's quite a story. And just as they're processing all this, that's when the two young monks show up with tea.
What about Baji and Xiaowujing?
Ah, well, back in the main hall, things are a bit more down to earth. They're starting to grumble
About what?
about how late it's getting. They remind everyone, hey, time's ticking. We have to be ready to leave at the crack of dawn, you know, when the rooster crows.
Huh. Trust Baji and Wujing to bring things back to the practicalities of travel.
Exactly. It's another one of those grounding moments, a bit of humor contrasting with the deep mystery they've just uncovered.
A necessary balance, maybe.
Perhaps. And quite beautifully, actually. A poetic description of the night setting in.
Oh.
Yeah, it talks about the moon sinking, a gentle breeze glowing, the characters finally settling down to sleep. It paints this picture of nighttime calm.
But underneath that calm.
Right. Underneath, these questions about the princess are swirling. It sets up the next part of the journey perfectly. There's peace, but also this unresolved tension. They're up before dawn.
Just as they're leaving this place, Dujin Shanxi, Jigu Temple.
Right. And it's worth noting the vibe straight away. Getting ready to leave while all these merchants are also preparing gives you a sense of movement.
And there's this moment as they leave, it's really interesting. The old monk at the temple says something to Wukong, calls it a sorrowful matter, says it's a real princess back home in his heart.
Yeah.
Kind of cryptic. Wukong, says you can figure everything out here, sounds, see colors, know what's what, solving the mystery once they get to the city. So they travel all morning, go through Chicken Crow Pass, and then late morning they see it, this amazing city. The source uses some pretty grand language. Iron Urn, Golden City, Divine Land, Heavenly Abode. Really painting a picture.
Yeah, and that description is important. It builds this image of like total strength and prosperity. Talks about dragon crouching, tiger perched forms, phoenix towers, signs of a good king, good harvest, talented people. It looks perfect, stable, beautiful.
They go into the East Market Street. Now the merchants head off to regular inns, but our monks go to this Huthong guest house. It sounds more official.
It does.
And the inn steward hears about four unusual monks with a white horse and right away assumes they're officials. That white horse detail seems significant.
It is significant. It shows that the horse immediately signals status. It's tied to their imperial mission. So the steward is like, okay, important people, and offers them lodging right away. It's a subtle clue about who they are even before the big reveal.
So Tang Monk introduces himself, imperial envoy, Tang Dynasty, going for scriptures, needs his papers checked by the king. Standard procedure for him. But then the steward actually sees the disciples. And suddenly he's terrified. Why such a strong reaction?
Well, the text says he's secretly startled. I mean, their faces are described as ugly. He's literally wondering if they're ghosts or humans, starts trembling. It really drives home just how otherworldly and intimidating the disciples look compared to normal people, not like the elegant horse at all.
Right. And Tang Monk has to step in, calm the guy down, says something like, yeah, they look rough, but their hearts are good. He even quotes a saying, wicked mountains, good people, why be afraid? What does that tell us, bigger picture, about the story?
It's hammering home that theme, isn't it? Look past the surface.
Yeah.
It's all through Journey to the West. What you see isn't always what you get, character over appearance. And the steward does calm down then, enough to ask where Tang Monk is actually from.
Tang Monk tells him, Nanshan Buzu's Zhonghua Land, left home Zhenguan 13th year, which he mentions was 14 years ago. 14 years. After crossing countless waters and mountains, you really feel the weight of that journey.
Absolutely. It frames everything he's been through. And then the steward gives them the local lowdown, says they're in Great India, a kingdom that's been around over 500 years. The current king is Emperor Yuzong. His reign name is Jingyan, and he's been ruling for 28 years. Loves mountains and flowers, apparently. It just grounds the story in this, specific place and time, even if it's fictional.
Okay, so Tang Monk wants to see the king, get his papers sorted, and the steward says, perfect timing. And this is where things take a bit of a left turn for our heroes.
Right, because the steward explains the king's daughter, the princess, she's 20, and she's doing this throwing the embroidered ball thing right now from a decorated tower. It's how she's choosing a husband, a heaven-matched marriage custom, he calls it. And the king is apparently there for the event. So, yeah, seems like a good time to approach the court. Like fate, almost.
Tang Monk's keen to go, and Zhu Baji, naturally, wants in on the action too, wants to see the princess.
Of course he does.
But Shou Wujing, the sensible one, tells Baji, maybe not you, your face. He suggests Wukong should go with the master instead. Seems strategic.
It totally is. Shows Wujing thinking ahead. Tang Monk agrees, calls Baji clumsy and Wukong more delicate. Baji grumbles a bit, saying his face isn't that different from Wukong's, which is pretty funny. But it highlights that, yeah, appearances matter here.
So off they go. Tang Monk in his robes and Wukong. Streets are packed. Everyone's going to see the ball throwing. Scholars, merchants, everyone. And Tang Monk notices things. The clothes, the houses, how people talk. It all feels quite similar to his home, the Tang Dynasty. He even remembers his own mother chose his father the same way, with an embroidered ball.
Yeah, that's a key detail. It makes him feel comfortable, you know? familiar, maybe a little nostalgic. It sort of lowers his defenses, makes him feel at ease in this foreign place. And that feeling of ease, that sense of normalcy, that's exactly what makes the deception that's coming so much more effective.
Teng Monk pauses for a second, worries maybe their monk clothes will look weird, cause suspicion. But Wu Guang, sharp as ever, connects it back, remembers the old monk's warning, that sorrowful matter.
Right.
He says basically, let's go check out this tower and let's figure out what's real and what's fake. He argues the king's too busy with the princess stuff to deal with state business anyway, so now's the time. Teng Monk agrees. But the story lets us in on a secret they don't know yet, right?
Exactly. This is where the narration pulls back the curtain for us. We learn that 2 years ago, a demon snatched the real princess while the royal family was out looking at the moon. And this demon then disguised itself as the princess.
Whoa. And this demon somehow knew Kang Monk would be there on that exact day, at that exact time. How?
It seems so. The text implies incredible foresight or maybe some demonic intel network. We don't know for sure. But the plan is specific. It used the kingdom's money to build this whole fancy tower setup specifically to lure Teng Monk. Not for love, obviously.
Right. It wants to marry him to collect his original Yang essence. What is that exactly? And why does the demon want it?
So original Yang essence in this sort of Taoist-influenced context is like the purest, most vital life force of a man, especially a spiritually pure man like Teng Monk. The demon believes if it can absorb this essence, it can achieve a huge power-up, become a great Tai Yi immortal, which is a seriously high level of divinity. So the stakes are cosmic, you see. It's not just a trick. It's a plan for apotheosis built on deception.
Okay, so it's exactly noon. Teng Monk and Wukong are in the crowd. The fake princess comes out, lights incense, prays. Then she looks down, spots Teng Monk right there, takes the embroidered ball, and just chucks it right onto his head.
Bam! Just like that. Precision targeting. His hat gets knocked sideways. He reflexively catches the ball. It rolls into his sleeve, and the crowd just explodes. He caught a monk. A monk got the ball. It's instant public chaos, and he's caught, literally.
People start rushing him, trying to grab the ball, maybe. But Wukong reacts instantly. He shouts, grinds his teeth, bends down, and suddenly he's huge. Like 3 Zhang tall, was that maybe 30 feet, shows his terrifying ugly face.
Classic Wukong move. What happens then?
Predictable effect. The crowd panics. People are falling over each other, scrambling to get away. Total chaos.
Clears the space.
Exactly. Leaves Wukong and Teng Monk standing there alone. Then Wukong shrinks back to normal size. He bought them a moment.
Okay, crisis averted for a second, but now what?
Well, now all the attendants from the Tower Maidens, eunuchs, they rush down, bow to Teng Monk and basically say, come to court, celebrate your amazing good fortune.
Good fortune. For a monk who's sworn off marriage, this is quite the predicament. How does Teng Monk react? He must be furious.
Oh, he is. He immediately blames Wukong.
Yeah, you...
Monkey, tricking me again.
Classic.
But Wukong's just like, hey, the ball hit your head, rolled into your sleeve. What's it got to do with me? Don't complain to me. Completely deadpan, probably.
Cheeky, but you can see the wheels turning. He's got a plan brewing behind that denial, right?
Definitely. Teng Monk asks, okay, what do we do about this mess? And Wukong lays it out, tells Teng Monk, don't sweat it, go to court.
Go towards the problem. Interesting.
Sure. Yeah. Wukong says he'll go back to the inn, tell Baji and Wu Jing to wait. Now, if the princess doesn't push the marriage thing, fine. They just get the travel papers stamped and leave. Simple. But if she insists on marrying him, Teng Monk should tell the king, hold on, I need to talk to my disciples first, give them instructions.
Ugh, stalling tactic. But there's more to it, I bet.
Exactly. Wukong says, when they summon us 3 to court, meaning himself, Baji, and Wu Jing, I will be able to distinguish true from false.
There it is.
He calls it a plan to subdue the monster by relying on the marriage. So Wukong's already figured it out. He's connected the old monk's warning to this whole princess situation. He knows she's fake.
Wow. So he's not just reacting, he's setting his own trap, using the demon's own plan against it. That's brilliant, actually, playing along to expose the truth.
Teng Monk doesn't really have another option, does he? So he agrees. Wukong heads back to the inn to brief the others.
And leaves Teng Monk heading towards a very awkward royal audience.
I mean, talk about being in the wrong place.
Or the right place, depending on your perspective, I suppose. But yes, for him, definitely the wrong clue.
So what happens then? Chaos.
Pretty much immediate chaos, yes. He's instantly surrounded by palace maids, attendants, eunuchs. the whole group, they basically push and escort him up to the tower.
Wow.
Then the princess herself comes down, takes his hand, and next thing you know, they're boarding this magnificent carriage together, full retinue, heading straight back to the palace.
He's being taken to become a royal son-in-law.
That's exactly what's happening. He's being fast-tracked to royalty.
Okay, so the king gets the news. His official tells him the princess is bringing in a monk, the one hit by the ball. The king's first reaction isn't great, is it?
No, not at all. He's initially quite displeased, actually wants to just send the monk away.
But he doesn't.
He holds back. Crucially, he wants to find out what his daughter wants first. So Tang Sanzang finds himself in this massive royal dilemma.
How does he even begin to handle that? Especially when, you know, his whole life is about not this.
It's a fascinating moment. They arrive at the Golden Throne Hall, Tang Sanzang and the princess. And the text gives this really striking description. A pair of husband and wife calling out, "Long live," and two gates, evil and righteous, vowing for 1,000 years.
That really sets up the conflict, doesn't it?
Right.
Good versus evil, or maybe sacred versus profane.
Precisely. It highlights the core tension. The king speaks first, asks Tang Sanzang, you know, where are you from? How did you end up getting hit by my daughter's ball?
So he's been basically swept up into this marriage against his will.
Yeah.
What's his immediate response? Does he protest?
Oh, absolutely. Immediately and desperately. He explains he's just a poor monk, you know, from the great Tang Empire, sent by his emperor to get scriptures from the West, from Lion Monastery.
He just wants to get his travel paper stamped, right?
Exactly. He says he's just there to exchange his osha, his travel documents. He emphasizes he's a sekto, someone on a renounced religious path. He says he wouldn't dare become a consort to a draw, a royal princess, you know, someone of noble birth.
He's pleading for his life.
Literally, pleading to just exchange the documents, let him go quickly to Spirit Mountain, get the scriptures, and go home.
You'd think such a, well, heartfelt plea from a holy man might work. But the king, he sees it differently.
Completely differently. The king declares it's, oh.
A 1,000-mile marriage tied by a thread of destiny. That sounds pretty final.
It's a very powerful cultural idea. This invisible red thread connecting fated couples. The king points out his daughter is 20, unmarried, and this specific day was chosen as auspicious for this ball-throwing ceremony.
So it's fate.
In the king's eyes, yes. He admits he wasn't happy at first, but now he sees it as destiny, and he has to respect his daughter's choice, or perhaps heaven's choice.
But the princess, she's not just standing by, is she? She actually plays a role here.
Oh, a huge role. She steps forward and makes this incredibly strong statement. She quotes a saying.
Meaning?
Marry a chicken, follow the chicken. Marry a dog, follow the dog. Basically, whoever she marries, she'll follow their path or accept her lot.
Okay.
And she says she made a vow beforehand to heaven and earth, treating this whole thing like a heaven-arranged marriage.
So because he was hit?
It means it was destiny from a past life, which led to this meeting in this life. She absolutely insists on marrying him. It's quite a declaration of her own will within this framework of destiny.
Wow. So the princess seals the deal. The king must be happy now.
Yes, with her declaration, the king is finally pleased. He immediately orders the imperial astrologer to pick a wedding date. Preparations for the dowry spurt. Announcements go out.
And Tang Sanzang, the monk who wants none of this. How does he react to this acceptance of his fate?
Well, his reaction is definitely not gratitude. He just keeps pleading over and over.
Forgive, forgive, like, let me go.
Exactly. Just a desperate plea for release.
Which, understandably, probably doesn't go over well with the king.
Not at all. The king is incensed. He calls him an unreasonable monk. He's like, I'm offering you the wealth of the nation, royalty, and all the monk cares about is getting scriptures.
Does he try to force him?
He does. He threatens him. Says if he keeps refusing, he'll have the imperial guards execute him.
Whoa. Okay, that's serious.
Absolutely serious. And it terrifies Tang Sanzang. The text says he's scared out of his wits, completely terrified.
So at that point,
he has no choice. He has to bow down and accept. The threat is too real.
You can really feel his panic there. Okay, so he's accepted under duress, but he makes one last try, doesn't he? A final plea.
He does. It's quite clever in a desperate way. He brings up his three disciples waiting outside.
Wukong, Pigsy, and Sandy.
Right. He says he needs to make sure they get the travel document stamped and are sent on their way to the West to continue the mission. He asks for them to be summoned from the inn.
And the king agrees.
Yes, the king agrees. He probably thinks, okay, the monk has accepted he's staying, let's sort out his companions. So he asks where they are and sends an official off to fetch them, fully intending to keep Tang Sanxiang as his son-in-law.
So while the master is caught in this royal mess, what's happening back at the inn with the disciples? They have no idea, right?
None at all. So Sun Wukong, monkey, he gets back to the inn first, and he's apparently laughing his head off.
Laughing? Why?
Well, Pigsy and Sandy see him, ask why he's so happy where the master is, and Wukong delivers what he calls the good news.
Which is?
That their master's happy, and when they press him, he spills the beans. The master got hit by the embroidered ball, got taken to court, and he's going to marry the princess, become the royal son-in-law.
Oh, I can only imagine Pigsy's reaction to that news.
It's exactly what you'd expect. He stamps his feet, beats his chest, wailing about how he should have gone.
Of course.
He's picturing himself getting hit by the ball, marrying this beautiful princess, saying how wonderful it would have been, calling it, graceful, proper, good fun for everyone involved.
Always focused on the pleasures, isn't he?
Always. Sandy, though, true to form, gives Pigsy a metaphorical slap across the face, calls him shameless, a bee mouth.
What does Sandy say?
He basically scoffs that if Pigsy had been hit, they'd already be burning funeral offerings for him that night, implying it would have been a total disaster.
Light chuckle. Probably true. And Pigsy's response?
Oh, he defends himself. Says something like, ugly is ugly, but there's still some flavor. Quotes, meaning rough skin, strong bones, each has its own merits. Always finding a way to justify himself.
Gotta love Pigsy. So Wukong steps in.
Yeah, Wukong tells him to stop talking nonsense, pack the bags, because he figures the master will call for them soon.
But Pigsy's not convinced they're needed anymore.
Not at all. He argues, look, the master's a son-in-law now, you know, enjoying himself with the princess. He won't be climbing mountains or fighting monsters. Why would he need them? Especially for, bedchamber matters. Oh, Pigsy.
Pigsy chuckles. Exactly. Wukong is completely fed up at this point, calls him a coo. A lustful, dense idiot grabs his ear, starts cursing him out.
And right in the middle of this squabble.
Perfect timing. The innkeeper rushes in, announces an imperial summons for the three divine monks.
Does Pigsy put two and two together?
Immediately. He asks, is it because our master got chosen as the son-in-law? And the innkeeper confirms it.
Meanwhile, the poor official who's come to fetch them, he sees Wukong.
And he is absolutely terrified, muttering to himself, like, is it a ghost, a monster, some kind of thunder god? Wukong has to tell him to speak clearly. The official just trembles and nervously repeats the summons.
Pigsy tries to calm him down. Yeah, Pigsy says, hey, we don't have torture instruments here. But Wukong just tells the official to stop being scared of his face, hurry up, pack the bags, get the horse. They need to go to the palace and talk to their master.
What a scene. It's chaos, comedy, and high stakes all rolled into one. And then right at the end of this section, the text includes a poem. What's the significance of that?
Ah, yes. The poem is fascinating because it provides this incredibly stark contrast to all the worldly drama they've just been through. It acts almost like a philosophical commentary.
How so?
Well, it talks about achieving the great elixir, needing three complete, which implies spiritual cultivation. It mentions bitter practice hard to achieve, hating evil or negative karmic ties.
Sounds very Buddhist.
Very much so. It says Tao, the way, is transmitted by saints, but cultivation is up to oneself. Goodness comes from humans, fortune from heaven, and then it gets really direct.
What does it say?
It warns, don't indulge the six senses in greed and desire. It urges one to suddenly open one's nature to its original state, to be without love, without thought, naturally pure, which guarantees liberation.
So it's basically holding up the highest ideal of non-attachment.
Precisely. Right after Tang Sanxiang has been forced into the ultimate worldly attachment, marriage, royalty, wealth, it directly reflects his dilemma, highlighting that clash between his spiritual vows and these sudden, overwhelming worldly temptations and obligations. It makes his struggle feel even more profound.